From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents from around the globe. I'm Dee Dee Skanky. This week, we go to Tibet, where dissent is taking on a new and disturbing form. In China, we meet a man who is trying to feed thousands. In Ireland, we check in on how well the economic medicine has helped the wounded Celtic tiger. And in Haiti, we visit a fast-growing church that grew out of the 2010 earthquake. But we start this week's podcast in Nigeria. In Nigeria, Islamist militants have waged deadly attacks in Kano, the biggest city in the nation's mainly Muslim north. The bombings have cost the lives of nearly 200 people in the past week alone, and the attacks have traumatized civilians, especially those who hail from other parts of the country, including the largely Christian south. They feel under threat from the rebels, and as we hear from NPR's Ophabia Quist Arkton in Kano, they're fleeing the city in droves.
It's bedlam at New Road bus station here in the heart of Kano. Scores of children, women and men are milling around with huge bundles and baggage in all shapes and sizes, waiting to be loaded onto half a dozen buses. Others are already on board. They're heading south, out of town, and they're in a hurry, desperate to leave the city and northern Nigeria. 32-year-old businesswoman and mother of four boys, Kemi Ezioha, says she's scared.
In the bomb blast, they normally kill both Christian and Muslim. We can't go to church, we can't pray, we can't do anything. All we do is, just, you know, you're not safe.
You're not safe.
Others, like Glory Indudi, standing nearby, nod vigorously in agreement. She's wearing a red T-shirt and a deep frown etched on her forehead. Her five children have already taken their seats on a bus.
So we don't want to stay, we want to go. We want to go, we are tired. Can't you see the way I'm feeling? I'm shaking here, I don't want to stay, I'm going. I don't want to die here. So I'm going.
Both Ezioha and Indudi are Christians, originally from southern Nigeria. They're part of the Igbo business community that has lived in Kano for generations alongside the mainly Muslim majority in northern Nigeria's metropolis. But now they're too frightened to remain here because of the threat from the radical Islamist Boko Haram sect. Deadly multiple bombings last week have shaken residents in Kano and shaken many people's faith in being able to continue living side by side with assailants they feel want them dead. Sweating in the heat of the bus, Glory Indudi's 13-year-old daughter, Clara, has this message for Boko Haram.
We want them to just stop it and live a good life like other people.
We want them to just stop it and lead a good life like other people. They should look around. They are taking lives, old women and little children. They are taking people's lives, and we want them to stop.
Boko Haram initially targeted government and security institutions in what appeared to be a battle against the state. But in recent weeks, the militants have also bombed churches and are warning Christians to leave the north. Governor Rabiu Musa Kwankwaso gathered community, religious and traditional leaders together this week to discuss the way forward for Kano. Leonard Mwosu heads the Umbrella Association for the city's Igbo community. He says that while the government has promised to step up protection for civilians, that isn't enough for many people.
Well, it's really sad, but what do we do? Life is more sacred, life is more precious, life is first. If they wish to stay, the government have assured us security. When they feel that the security has finally been restored in Kano State, they might come back.
Observers warn that the problem in the north is not between Christians and Muslims, but about Nigerians, some of them Boko Haram members, who feel let down by the authorities and excluded from jobs, opportunities, and education. So they use violence to try to polarize Africa's most populous nation and capture the president's attention. These explanations, though, do not convince Kemi Ezioha.
No. I don't really think I'll come back to Kano. This damn place, I'm sick and tired of this whole place. I don't think I'll come back. So I'm leaving Kano for good. Too bad, but I don't have a choice.
We are going. That's troubling for many people here. Ofebia Kustarkton, NPR News, Kano.
This week, Tibetans protested against Chinese rule with some of the largest demonstrations in 4 years. According to Tibetan rights groups, Chinese security forces opened fire on demonstrators, killing at least 4 people and wounding more than 30. The demonstrations were inspired in part by a disturbing new trend in Tibetan dissent, immolation. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports.
By most accounts, this week's demonstrations began with leaflets. They were distributed in the Tibetan region of China's far western Sichuan province. At least one urged people to protest Chinese rule by not celebrating Chinese New Year, which began Monday. The leaflet also contained something certain to stir strong feelings. Kate Saunders, who works with the International Campaign for Tibet, explains.
An unidentified Tibetan author was saying that he or she was preparing to set fire to themselves.
Since last March, 16 Tibetans have doused themselves with fuel and set themselves aflame to protest China's restrictive political and religious policies. This video shows a Tibetan teenager lying on a street, his blackened body still smoking. Women scream, and one repeats the name of Tibet's spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama. In part to mourn the loss of these people, hundreds staged public protests earlier this week. Kate Saunders describes what happened when Tibetans gathered in a public square in Sutta County on Tuesday.
Troops attempted to lock down the area. Troops fired at the Tibetans. It was a scene of terrible panic and fear. At least one Tibetan was shot dead. Others were shot. And we heard from Tibetan sources that after this occurred, the square was covered in blood. And there were tear gas canisters left on the scene.
China's government insists Tibetans started the violence. Xinhua, the government's official news agency, says a Tibetan mob attacked a police station with, quote, gasoline bottles, knives, and stones. Xinhua says 14 police were injured. Confirming the facts is extraordinarily difficult. Chinese security forces have blocked roads and prevented reporters from entering the region for months. NPR made 30 calls to hotels, restaurants, and other businesses in the area with no answer, suggesting the government is blocking outside calls as well. Lobsang Sangay is the prime minister of Tibet's government in exile in India. He says the self-immolations over the past year mark a distressing turn for the Tibetan freedom movement in China.
It's really sad. You know, it's really tragic that Tibetans are resorting to such extreme measures. Given a choice, anyone would like to leave. No one wants to die.
People are desperate, and that seems to be particularly true inside monasteries and some nunneries.
Robert Barnett runs the Modern Tibetan Studies program at Columbia University. He says since 2000, China has imposed particularly harsh conditions on some Tibetan areas in Sichuan province.
Attacks on the Dalai Lama personally, demanding that monks denounce the Dalai Lama. So they've lost the support and patience of people in those areas.
China's government blames the unrest and self-immolations on the Dalai Lama. The Communist Party claims he encourages the suicides to foment rebellion, something the Dalai Lama has denied. Earlier this week, U.S. State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland criticized China's latest crackdown.
We have repeatedly urged the Chinese government to address its counterproductive policies in the Tibetan areas, which have created tensions and threaten the unique religious, cultural, and linguistic identity of the Tibetan people.
China shows no sign of changing its approach. Tibetan activists say the areas where the protests occurred remain under lockdown. They also say they expect more demonstrations in the coming days. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Shanghai.
In rural China, it's not uncommon for school children to skip lunch. Not because they're too busy, they're simply too poor. But thanks largely to the efforts of one man, 25,000 poverty-stricken children in China are now getting a free lunch every day. And indirectly, his efforts have helped millions more. NPR's Louisa Lim has the story from Sean Shi.
For 10-year-old Xie Xiaoyuan, just getting to school is an ordeal. Her frostbitten ears a testament to this. I get up at 5 o'clock, she says. Then I comb my hair and start walking. She navigates a mountain path in the dark, trudging through snowstorms and mudslides. Then she has to get a bus for about 10 miles. She hasn't time to eat breakfast. For lunch, I spend 15 cents on 2 pieces of bread and a drink, she says. That's all she eats until dinner at home at 5 o'clock. That's all her family can afford, with an income of about $120 a month for 5 people. For a while, she even stopped going to school because they couldn't afford the bus fare, but they were told this is against the law. Many of her fellow students at Hujiaying Primary School go hungry every day. Headmaster Bai Baojun says his biggest challenge is left-behind kids, those whose parents have gone to the cities to make money.
About 80% of our kids have parents who've gone away to find work. For half our students, both parents have gone away, so they depend on their grandparents, who can't help with their homework.
China's growing income disparity can be seen here, not just in the dirt roads and lack of sanitation, but in the very bodies of these kids. As they do their daily exercises in the playground, they're warmly wrapped up, since the classrooms have no heating. But one recent survey found 12% of children in the poorest rural regions are stunted due to malnourishment. They're on average 2 to 6 inches shorter than city kids. One new grassroots program aims to change that by providing free lunches for countryside children. Through the internet, it solicits donations of less than 50 cents, enough for one meal per child per day. These are then donated to schools in the poorest places in China. At this school, the money pays for these basins of meat and tofu, which are being cooked in enormous metal vats. The school chef is cooking for more than 200. There's so much food in there, he's actually using a shovel to stir the food. Headmaster Bai gives a speech to mark the first official day of free lunch at the school.
Now, we're actually trying the free lunch. There's a spicy tofu dish, celery with meat, and mushrooms and greens, and it's actually really, really good. I would pay a lot more in a restaurant for this.
The kids line up eagerly. For most, this is the best meal of the day. Some, without parents here, even have to cook their own supper. This program is the brainchild of Deng Fei, a campaigning journalist from Phoenix Weekly News magazine. But even he's been blown away by the speed with which the free lunch project has caught on.
In 8 months, we've raised $4 million in funds. 900,000 people gave us money. We've helped 162 schools give free lunches to 25,000 children.
He's been working closely with local authorities, who sometimes contribute funds, in this case, building the school canteen. Since he started, the central government announced it will expand its own nutritional support program. It'll spend $2.5 billion, providing extra nutrition to 26 million Chinese kids in the countryside. Headmaster Bai believes Deng Fei's program prodded the government into action.
The government would probably have given some money for free lunches anyway, eventually. But I think it would have happened later.
In the dining room, the kids are wolfing down their food, giddy with joy. But this program is facing challenges, including how to monitor all the schools that take part. Here in Hujiaying, there are plans for a two-track system, with better meals for those that can pay more. Apparently, inequality is so entrenched in China that even within a poverty alleviation program, there are haves and have-nots. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
Coming up, Ireland shines during these dark days of debt in Europe. And in Haiti, earthquake survivors flock to an evangelical church. This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Dee Dee Skanky. We've heard a lot about the role of Greece in the Eurozone crisis. Greece is the bad kid in the small class of bankrupt nations that have gotten bailouts from the European Union and the International Monetary Fund. But there's a good kid in that class. The EU and the IMF say they're pleased with Ireland. But as NPR's Philip Reeves reports, the Irish are not pleased with them.
Let's turn back the clock a few years. Life back then was good to Breida Clancy. She'd just moved into her new house on the edge of a pretty market town called Ate.
Big garden, we have kitchen, lovely kitchen, back kitchen. We've a living room in there. This is our sitting room. We had a study there, which I've turned into a bedroom. So I have six bedrooms really at the minute.
Back then, Clancy's house was valued at roughly $650,000. It seemed a good investment. Property values were soaring. Those were the boom years, when Ireland was the Celtic tiger, when people went a little crazy.
They were building houses for sport. I mean, I don't know who they thought were going to buy them or live in them.
That's now a distant memory. Clancy works as a nurse in a government-funded home for the elderly. Thanks to Ireland's austerity programme, her rate of pay has been cut by a third. Her pension's also shrunk. So has the value of her home by more than half. Her house stands out because the others on her block are unoccupied, except when the local vandals drop by. Clancy's stoical about all this, though she admits it's painful.
Oh, I feel hurt, I suppose, but what can we do? I'm sure it will get better, but how much better it'll get? It'll never be back to the boom again. Never. And I feel for my children there won't be a whole lot.
One of those children, a daughter, is about to head off to Australia, joining the thousands of Irish emigrating every month in search of work. Unemployment in Ireland's above 14%. Clancy and her husband, a bar owner, have two other kids to put through college. From now on, she says, there'll be no more holidays. Ireland's beginning its second year of austerity. There have been tax rises, wage freezes, layoffs, and more besides. This is being supervised by the so-called Troika, the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. These are the bodies that bailed out Ireland after the property bubble burst and its banks collapsed. The other day, the Troika dropped by for a routine check on Ireland's progress and at a press conference delivered a glowing report.
And I have to say that so far the Irish economy's performance is really impressive. The growth coming from net export is very large. The contribution is very large. I'm not suggesting that we don't have yet major challenges. That was my opening statement. But you also have results here.
That's Isvan Zeke of the European Commission. The Troika says it's pleased that Ireland's meeting its targets in cutting its once yawning deficit. Many Irish take no pleasure in receiving this pat on the back, as journalist Vincent Brown made clear at the same press conference.
This isn't good. This isn't good enough. This isn't good enough. You people are intervening in this society, causing huge damage by requiring us to make payments, not for the benefit of anybody in Ireland, but for the benefit of European financial institutions. Now, could you explain why the Irish people are inflicted with this burden?
Well, I think I have a good question.
You've nothing to say. There's no answer. Is that right?
The burden Brown's talking about is one particular debt. When Ireland's now defunct Anglo-Irish Bank hit the rocks, the government nationalised it and poured in money from its central bank. Paying back that money is now costing the Irish government about $4 billion a year.
We want 100% write-down on this debt.
Nessa Ní Cásada is part of a new campaign by a coalition of social justice groups to press Ireland's government to suspend repayments.
The Anglo debt is what is keeping Ireland from entering into any possibility of economic recovery. It's a huge percentage of our overall debt.
The campaign estimates it'll cost the Irish taxpayer more than $60 billion to settle that debt over the next few decades. It's not part of the bailout agreement. Yet the Troika's worried if Ireland doesn't pay this money, this will have a domino effect, threatening Europe's banking system. In Ireland's capital, Dublin, a hut erected by the Occupy Ireland movement is festooned with posters berating financiers and politicians and the Anglo-Irish Bank. Activist Steve Bennett says paying the Anglo debt is ridiculous. He predicts Irish taxpayers will eventually reject it.
We could sit back as a people and take it for quite a while, but eventually we will have to rise up. Eventually we're going to have to stop it.
Stopping it, says Bennett, means a campaign of non-violent civil disobedience. Philip Reeves, NPR News, London.
And we end this podcast in Haiti, where one of the fastest growing churches in the country grew out of the devastating 2010 earthquake. The Shalom Tabernacle of Glory Church began in a storefront in Port-au-Prince just days before the quake destroyed much of the capital. The evangelical mission now claims to have more than 50,000 members and one of the most popular radio stations in Haiti. NPR's Jason Beaubien has the story.
On January 12th, for the second anniversary of the earthquake, thousands of people flocked to the Shalom Church in Port-au-Prince. The church is just a plywood stage under a patchwork of tattered tarps. The crowd was so large that it spilled down a muddy hill towards a tent camp for earthquake victims. Most of the singing, swaying people in the congregation were so far away they couldn't even see the podium. This church is a product of the earthquake. Father André Mouskadin formed it because he says God had told him there was going to be a disaster. And a few days later, the quake hit. In the aftermath of the quake, Shalom grew rapidly, Father Mouskadin says, as many Haitians turned to religion for strength and assistance. But why, I asked him, did they turn to his church in particular? Because we have God here, he says with a laugh. He also has an extremely powerful radio transmitter that broadcasts his evangelical message and music across the country. Mouskadin says miracles occur at the services held under the tarps outside his office. For example, people here who were blind are now able to see, he says. The mute are all of a sudden able to speak. People injured in the earthquake can walk again. Parishioners also say they've seen miracles occur in front of them at Shalom. The services last for hours and involve a succession of preachers. On this Sunday, Pastor Joseph Josier, in a black suit with a purple shirt, is delivering a passionate sermon. With determination, courage, and conviction, he tells the congregation, you can have everything you want. A central message at Shalom is that if you give to God, God will give back to you. He'll give you money, a baby, a husband, a new car. Shalom is a powerful fundraising machine, asking for donations during the services, online and over the radio. Father Mouskadin won't say how much revenue he brings in, but he proudly declares everything he's built has been built by Haitians. Amidst the millions of dollars in international aid that's poured into Haiti after the quake, Mouskadin says his rapidly growing ministry is funded by lots of small donations from church members. There are no formal tools to measure radio audiences in Haiti. Mouskadin claims that Radio Shalom is now the most popular station in the country. Richard Widmeyer, who runs a rival commercial broadcaster, Radio Metropole, says a survey last year found Shalom indeed to be the most listened to station in Haiti.
Well, to tell you the truth, I was shocked myself because I had never heard of Radio Shalom.
Widmeyer says the religious broadcaster has become a powerful force in the country, and he concedes it's attracting a lot of listeners. Jeff Berard has his radio tuned to Shalom, in his words, 24/7.
They're bringing a lot of people using the radio to bring people back to Christ. You know, people who didn't have hope anymore, you know, they give them hope.
Berard has just stepped off the stage where he was playing keyboards during a marathon Sunday service at Shalom. After the earthquake, he says a lot of people felt lost and abandoned. Berard says the appeal of Shalom is that Father Mouskadin understands the plight of ordinary Haitians, and his church has become a refuge for them.
You know, a lot of people, you know, lost their homes and living under tents. And as you can see, the church is under a tent right now. So trying to serve God, even though you don't have anything, you know, it's a really tough thing to do. But you can see, as you can see here, people are just giving themselves to God, even though they don't know what they're going to eat after.
As the Sunday Mass at Shalom builds to a crescendo, some people in the congregation are swept up completely by the service. The pastor calls for sinners to come forward and give themselves to Christ, to be born again. Screams punctuate the singing. A large woman in a white dress holding a baby starts to shake violently. Ushers grab the baby out of her arms before she collapses in the dirt. Other people start fainting throughout the crowd. They're battling evil spirits, the pastor says, and the evil spirits fly out of their bodies when they collapse. When they come to a few minutes later, they're cleansed. And then the members of the Shalom congregation slowly file out from under the tarps back into the quake-ravaged streets of Port-au-Prince. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Dee Dee Skanky.